WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. My name is Don Nolan. I'm filling in for Steve this afternoon. He is out of the country. And our guest is Dr. Amy Penny, who is a professor of English at Parkland College. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us. We have invited Amy because she's involved in a workshop series entitled The Spirituality of Teaching at Parkland, which she's done in the past, I understand. Last semester, is that right?
I did. I got a session or two going last semester, and there was a lot of response to that over the summer, and decided that we would do a Parker Palmer reading group this year to keep going with that.
And Parker Palmer is the focus of our conversation. Parker Palmer is a very interesting fellow. He's a professor of sociology. I take it he's retired now. Is that right? Or is he still?
I think he is, but he does a lot more with higher ed. I think he's working with the Fetzer Institute, that kind of thing.
He's written a book entitled The Courage to Teach, Exploring the Inner Landscape of a Teacher's Life. This was published in 1998, and the book is billed as based on the premise that good teaching cannot be reduced to technique, but comes from the identity and integrity of the teacher, and it explores, as he says, a number of themes central to informal education and to teaching. And we're going to talk about what he means by the courage to teach and the inner life of the teacher. But before we get to Dr. Palmer's work and the workshop that you're doing at Parkland, let's talk a little bit about your background. How did you get to Parkland College? Where had you been before?
Well, I did my undergraduate work at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and then came out here to the University of Illinois for my master's and PhD in English. And then shortly after completing my PhD work here, got a job across town at Parkland, which is actually kind of what I was hoping to do about towards the end of working on my dissertation. I remember one of my advisors asked me, you know, what exactly are you wanting to do? Where are you wanting to go? And I actually kind of had my heart set on Parkland fairly early on. I had taught part-time at Parkland a little bit during my graduate studies. So it was actually what I wanted to do, and I was happy to be able to hang out in central Illinois and go across town and start teaching.
Now, how'd you get interested in the subject of spirituality?
I've always been interested in the subject of spirituality. I don't know. That one goes back pretty far. But in terms of its relationship to teaching, you know, it wasn't what first drove me into teaching by any stretch of the imagination. I was driven into teaching more by William Shakespeare. But
That will do it.
He'll do it, too. But after that, I think it came out of a need, and Palmer talks a little bit about this. It came out of a need to connect parts of my life, the sort of spiritual life and my avocation as a teacher. And I think, you know, the longer you teach, the more you want to make those types of connections, or the more those types of connections start happening for you, and it's time to pay attention to them.
Now, you have a Roman Catholic background, is that right?
I grew up Southern Baptist.
Oh.
And made the conversion not too long ago to Catholicism, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because I was a nun in a former life or something like that, and I think I missed my calling to be a nun. So for all those women religious out there, I appreciate the hard work that they've done, and all of the education and hospital building that women religious have done.
Right.
So.
Grew up in South Carolina?
I grew up in Georgia and then headed out to Colorado for high school, and then wound up in North Carolina for college, and then out here for graduate school.
So how did you get rid of the accent?
Colorado. In Colorado, during high school, I was in speech a lot, speech and theater, speech and theater, speech and theater. And
so you practiced.
I had to practice.
I had a professor of speech communication find out that I was from Texas, and she asked why I got rid of my accent, and I said, well, I was hoping to preach like Billy Graham and pontificate like Walter Cronkite, and she says, that's a shame. You should have kept it. Kind of like Molly Ivins, you know?
Mm-hmm. when my daddy comes to visit, it comes back.
Does it?
Mm-hmm.
You can slip back easily?
Yes, very easily.
Same here. Well, let's talk a little bit about The Courage to Teach. This book, as I said earlier, came out in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit of information on Parker Palmer. You can feel free to add to this. This is just in his blurb. He has been named one of the 10 key agenda setters of the past decade, particularly in the area of education. He's been acknowledged with 8 honorary doctorates and several national awards. In the book, Courage to Teach, he says he's trying to tie together core themes of 40 years of work. As he puts it, the shape of the integral life, the meaning of community, teaching and learning for transformation, and so on and so on. And he talks about what you mentioned earlier in your own experience, coming to terms with living a divided life, mm-hmm. which so many of us live, I suppose. And he, as a sociologist, apparently attempts to come to terms with that, and he uses a phrase of a Trappist monk in which he says that what he hopes to tap into is the hidden wholeness that embraces the brokenness of our lives and the flaws in those around us. What is he talking about?
Oh, goodness. Well, I'm not exactly sure. I'm not really a Palmer expert, but I certainly feel like I'm out to carry out his message as much as possible. I think we all, as especially teachers, but to any kind of teacher or learner, we need to make connections. I think, in terms of learning theory, we know that students learn much more effectively when they're making connections, when they've got scaffolding, to use mm-hmm. actual, educational language.
Educationese.
Yeah. So I think any learner needs to make connections, needs to connect some new piece that they're learning with some old piece that they already know, and then that learning's much more likely to stick. And I think that's true for the inner landscape. It's true for the inner life of the teacher. It's true for all of us, that our work, our learning, and our spiritual lives, whatever that may mean, will come to more fruition when we're able to make those connections and when we're able to reflect on those connections. And as teachers especially, we need to be about the work of finding ways to make those connections, and both in ourselves, for ourselves, with our colleagues, how we do this in professional conferences, all of those kinds of things. That's how we're going to be more effective in the classroom, whether it be a virtual classroom or a physical space, with our students.
Just to make sure that our listeners know, this is a call-in show. If you would like to call in a question or make a comment to our guest, Dr. Amy Penny, who is with us to talk about the book by Parker Palmer entitled The Courage to Teach, you can call in locally at 333-9455. You can also use an 800 number if you prefer, 1-800-222-9455. Well, we've mentioned the term a couple of times, the inner life of a teacher. Palmer says inner landscape of teaching. What does he mean by that?
I think he really literally means that place in us that we can go to. I think in some ways he means it as almost a spiritually physical space that we can go to draw from, a place where we can almost retreat to. I'm a big fan of Thomas Merton, and he also is a reader of Merton. And I think that whole notion of going into the desert, going to a landscape to draw inspiration, to figure out ways to make those connections, we have to find ways to connect deeply to that and to retreat into that landscape mm-hmm. in order to recharge, if you will, or sometimes to learn something new. I'm constantly having to learn new things as an English teacher. It isn't like language stays the same. I mm-hmm. have to stay on my game. So I think that that's kind of what he's talking about. And he mentions a couple of times in his book about the fact that, he's been doing retreats and workshops for teachers, K-12 teachers and higher education teachers for years, and talking about the inner landscape. And a lot of people will make fun of this stuff and they'll call it
touchy-feely.
Touchy-feely. Mm-hmm. Touchy-feely. And he talks a little bit about that in his one of his newer works. And it is touchy-feely. This is the touchy-feely stuff. But it ultimately, that's the stuff that's going to keep us together. That landscape, that inner landscape, is where we go to draw our fuel to stay and to be good teachers and to constantly want to learn something new in order to share that with our students.
He also talks about the what question, the how question, the why question. You want to speak to that? This passage where he discusses this is widely quoted. What is he getting at there?
Yeah, this is a quote that comes early in the book, and I think it's what drew a lot of the people into the book who have been involved with the study group so far at Parkland College, and that is that this kind of represents the journey that we take. We initially worry about the what question, what subject are we going to teach, and then we think about how. We start wondering, well, how am I going to best do this? What are the best practices? What are the techniques? Then we will often, and maybe kind of recursively do this, ask why we're teaching. What is the purpose of our teaching? To what ends do we teach? But seldom, he says, do we ask the critical question, which is the who question. Who is the self that teaches? And importantly, who are the selves, the students in the class? Who are those selves that teach? And how are we making connections, whether we're teaching math or English or physics or astronomy? How is the self that teaches, and who is the self that teaching, connecting to the student? And those are very deep questions that, in between grading midterms and prepping for the next class and getting our own kids in and out of school, that we don't often take the time to ask. Mm-hmm. But we need to take the time to ask that question. Who
is the self? So much busy work. There's so much to know. There's so many techniques to master. There's evaluation instruments, and there's the structural demands of the institution and the organization that the human being in front of you there in the classroom tends to get lost, and sometimes you even forget about yourself.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, and I think that's when we do that, and this doesn't come as a surprise to teachers out there, that's when we have burnout. Mm-hmm. That's when we get tired. That's when we get exhausted to the point that we feel we can't do the job and do it effectively.
And I was talking to you earlier. You say you've seen a good deal of this already in education.
The burnout?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, mm-hmm. I certainly have.
Certainly is widely spoken about in K-12.
Absolutely, and this is my 20th year of teaching college freshmen. Or sophomores, but primarily college freshmen. And I still love it. I still manage to retreat somehow to my inner landscape to feel passionately about it. But, especially long about March or April, I start getting awfully exhausted. And sometimes the level of apathy, mine and theirs, starts getting to me. And I really have to rely then on some of the hard work I've done in that inner landscape of the teacher, mm-hmm. Because I don't have any resources left mm-hmm. to work on anything else.
Well, let's go back to this question of the who. The Socratic question, know thyself, seems to be his focus. And he says, if I can quote from him, when I do not know myself, I cannot know my subject, not at the deepest levels. What's he getting at there?
That one's a big one. You're the philosophy teacher, Don, so, step in and help me out with Socratic things. But I do think he is talking very much about being able to reflect on the who and think about who he is as a teacher. I think this is easier for us, especially as humanities teachers, English teachers, social science maybe even. Mm-hmm. We constantly have to be thinking about that. And I think you do as a math teacher and a philosophy teacher and an astronomy teacher as well. But, I do think there's something about walking into a math class. And if you're not feeling great that day, you can still deliver your content. You can deliver what it is that's going on, what students need to know in terms of math.
Of course, computers can deliver content.
That's true. That's true. And some students can learn quite well by looking at the computer, but not very many, I think we're finding, mm-hmm. as a sole means of educational
right.
delivery. So I think that the thinking about the who and knowing, thinking more about yourself, certainly for me, if I'm not in my own game, then I'm not able to do that much with my subject. I can get out there and I can talk about comma splices and thesis statements, but mm-hmm. I'm certainly not engaging the students at the level of awareness that I want them to have when they leave the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, I think that's when I have to constantly retreat, literally, mm-hmm. you know, to the inner landscape.
I know that you're involved in assessment at Parkland.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to know, there's an earlier book. He's written several books. Some of them are quite remarkable. One of them is called The Active Life, and he says there, "I feel sorry for teachers who are required to spell out precise learning objectives long before class begins so that they can measure their own, quote-unquote, effectiveness. I feel sorry for their students, too, educated, dominated by preconceived images of what must be learned can hardly be educational." What do you think? Is he overstepping there? Is it emphasis too strong, or how do you feel?
Can I just say yes and no and then run away? I am actually referred to it by some circles at Parkland College as the assessment
guru.
Diva.
Uh-huh. Or guru.
Guru, assessment guy. I am really neither of those, but I am
I
am a facilitator. I am the chair of academic assessment and a co-facilitator of our 2012 self-study at Parkland College. So I have to think a lot about learning objectives, very measurable ones, and I have to find them, and I have to help faculty and staff to figure out how to negotiate the very rough terrain, to get back to that landscape metaphor, the very rough terrain of learning objectives and measuring student learning, because parents and higher learning commissions,
taxpayers
and a lot of other people want to know that the money that goes into education and money that goes into educating a person is actually going to produce a product. So there's that level. And it's, I think, to a certain extent, that is important. What drew me into assessment to begin with, if I can digress just a tiny bit, but it gets to the inner landscape. A lot of people have asked me that because I'm very anti-assessment. In a lot of ways, I don't think that most learning can be measured, and I don't think a lot of what's truly valuable can be measured very well.
The most important.
The most important. I don't. In higher education, for certain, but also in K through 12, I think there's a lot of learning that occurs that simply can't be measured, and it might be that that stuff is what's the most important.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my own personal philosophy. But what drew me into assessment is that assessment, to get a very specific example, a student, what I wanted to be able to show and demonstrate to the taxpayers and the stakeholders everywhere was that a student who wrote an essay after our 101 and 102 at Parkland College could write as an effective an essay, a product, as a student who was educated at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so at its core, that's what assessment does. It can show that here's this product. And you can get a group of teachers together, and they're not always going to agree on every single point, but you can get a group of teachers together, and you can demonstrate that a student can be just as well educated at the University of Illinois as they can at Harvard or Johns Hopkins or Parkland College, Richland, Lakeland. And that to me is the spirituality of assessment, which I have no intention of ever following up on that statement ever, ever, ever. But at its core, that's what assessment can do. And that to me is the beauty of the assessment movement.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, as with any bureaucracy and any system, it winds up that the devil's in the details.
Let me remind our listeners, if you'd like to call in, make a comment to our guest who is with us today on Keeping the Faith. We have with us Dr. Amy Penny, who is talking with us about a book entitled The Courage, I want to get the full title, The Courage to Teach, Exploring the Inner Landscape of a Teacher's Life, published in 1998 by Parker Palmer, and she is conducting a series of workshops on the spirituality of teaching with this book as her focus. If you'd like to make offer a question or make a comment, you can call in at 333-9455. You can also call 1-800-222-9455. So from your point of view, it's both and with regard to assessment. I've heard some people refer to summative versus formative assessment. You're really talking about summative, aren't you? where you look at the big picture, but you're not using it to drive what goes on in the classroom?
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested. You know, what I think is important is that you can demonstrate, like I said, to all stakeholders, whomever, students and parents and taxpayers, that that learning has definitely occurred. And you can look at it. And you can look at it and you say, you know, the student started here and the student wound up here. Mm-hmm. And that is definitely some progress. And it's not all going to just be because of your particular classroom, mm-hmm. right? I think that's where, you know, we talk a lot about, especially general education, assessing general education. Mm-hmm. Very, very tough work to do. And more people like, say, the Higher Learning Commission want to see that we're able to demonstrate right. that students have global awareness, civics, that they're aware of, you know, aesthetic concerns, right? That they're really emphasizing some of these things that we're talking about when we're talking about spirituality, when we're talking about some of these unmeasurable things. Now there's pressure placed on us to measure them. How can we show that students have aesthetic abilities to be able to determine good art from bad art?
Now, there has been a push to get down to the classroom, which is where Parker Palmer is primarily concerned about, right? Mm-hmm. But that has not resulted, I take it, at the higher education level. But clearly with No Child Left Behind, it has driven curriculum and driven teaching in the classroom for, what, 8-10 years now?
Absolutely. And it's really created, again, this doesn't come as a surprise to teachers out there, an overemphasis, I would argue, on, you know, the few things that can be measured, you know, your math classes, your English classes to a certain extent, some science classes. And it's really because it's been difficult to measure, say, some of the career areas or automotive or some of the creative areas, art, theater. Obviously, some of those programs get cut because you can't, especially in K-12, if you can't measure it, then it's not valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the,
right.
Legislators especially.
Or you can measure it, and then particularly in the area of music and art,
mm-hmm.
Curriculum in K-12, you're not really measuring music and art. You're measuring something else.
Right. You
know.
Right.
He also talks about a spirituality of ends that wants to dictate desirable outcomes. That's what we've been talking about with K-12. And he says that this marketing approach, this outcomes-based testing approach is no, quote-unquote, no education at all. He says that sort of education, to use his language, never gets started. It's no education at all. I'm not clear whether he's a fan of current education reforms or not. I assume from most of what he said he's very much a critic. Do you think he would agree with how you describe assessment?
I don't know. I wish he'd call. So if Parker Palmer, if you're listening, could you call?
Please call.
Please call.
The number is 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455.
Exactly. I mean, he's retired. Why he can't call?
Yeah.
I do think that he, you know, I don't know that I would go as far as he does. I'm a parent. I have two young children, and I, you know,
you write checks.
I write checks, and I send them to school, and I want them to come home and tell me what they've learned. And I'm kind of the assessment diva at home. I know when my kids walk in the door, when I ask them, you know, what did you learn today? I'm very specific. You know, mm-hmm. I want some learning outcomes. What did you learn specifically in your reading class today? Well, and you know, you get the typical nothing, and mm-hmm. then I have to press. And so I, you know, I understand the need to see in some way, you know, learning outcomes. I understand mm-hmm. that. There's nothing wrong with learning outcomes. As long as I think as what we balance that with is understanding that so much of what is learned at this point in higher ed, especially, and in K-12, isn't measured. So much of what's learned isn't currently measured. And some of it can't be, but much of it just isn't valued. It isn't what we value because it isn't the thing that will produce a job per se. Although when we do our futures conferences or some of our town halls at Parkland College and Dr. Ramage goes around and gathers information from the district, you know, what
Dr. Ramage is the president of Parkland College.
When he does that, what do we find out? What do employers want? They want people who can work well with others. They want people who have critical thinking skills. Mm-hmm. They want people who can communicate effectively, but especially people who are going to be good colleagues. And what does that mean? It means good people.
We have a caller from Decatur. Good afternoon. You're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or comment?
Good afternoon. My name is Mehul Patel.
Hi.
Hi, and I'm glad that this person's on from Parkland. One of the concerns that I've developed in thinking about education is a strong need, even at a K-12, up to K-12 level, meaning freshman high schools, students, to have a strong focus on commerce elective. For example, kids that know about bank balances, credit, just becoming frugal and well aware of finances, et cetera. And I think mortgages, real estate, investments, et cetera, I think that's a strong component that's almost missing in our curriculum. I could say the same for some kind of mandatory elective for college orientation or something that keeps them globally competitive at a science level or an elective that infuses some kind of programming, some kind of computer literacy. I wish the education curriculum would just be revamped from the ground up. Now, I've read studies about certain things. I guess there was once a sociology person that had written a book about education on a grander scale. But I wonder what your thoughts might be on these thoughts, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you for your question.
I agree, and I'm sure that there are a lot of teachers out there who would wholeheartedly and who are nodding their heads so hard that they might have hit something in front of them. I would love to see a lot more focus in K through 12 on finances, but also the ethics of finance. Wouldn't that be nice to teach, to have the time to teach students not just how to balance a checkbook, which is important, and what a mortgage is. Absolutely, the caller's right. But, you know, what are the ethics involved with how we have our how we handle our money? Obviously, that's been kind of an issue in the last year or so. At least highlighted in the media, mm-hmm. obviously.
From Wall Street on down.
From Wall Street on down. And so it would be great. But in the current climate and in the current budget, very rarely is there funding for that. There are very rarely teaching positions open for those kinds of classes. And there's so much, you know, quote unquote, other curriculum to get through that, that some of those things get ignored. But I wholeheartedly agree. I would love to see us kind of strip it bare and rebuild it.
Financial literacy?
No, financial literacy would be mm-hmm. wonderful for you know, like you said, you know, maybe freshmen or sophomores in high school, and then revisit that as a requirement, as a gen ed requirement in colleges, you know, ethics of finance.
You know, there are dozens and dozens of mandates that have been handed down from our local state education agency in Springfield to public schools, and so many of them are unfunded mandates that are just piled on top of each
other.
Those
are very popular mandates.
Yes, they are. You don't have to pay for them.
No.
If I once saw a list of all of the neat things that different people would love to see mandated, and it would have taken 3 years to get into one-year curriculum.
Yeah.
There's so many competing claims on what should be in the curriculum. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there are people who say, well, we just should do reading, writing, arithmetic,
yep.
and forget all
yep.
the other stuff.
Yep.
What would, since we're talking about the courage to teach and spirituality of teaching, where do you think Parker Palmer would come in on this question?
My thinking is He'd want to promote the courage to change the curriculum mm-hmm. and to continue to be an advocate to change the curriculum. And sometimes something like the economic crisis that we, you know, we found ourselves embroiled in the last few years, you know, it didn't come out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe it's times like this that we're able to say, you know, we need to change our focus. Reading, writing, and arithmetic is of the utmost importance. There's no question that a student needs to be able to read and to communicate effectively and to understand math. There's absolutely no question, and nobody's ever going to take away reading, writing, and arithmetic. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen. But what we do with that, and maybe how we assess it and how we teach it and how we infuse that part of the curriculum with other things like global awareness and civics and ethics, are there other creative ways that we can combine some of these crucial skills that, students do need to have? We are in a different world than we were in 100 years ago, and we need to teach students how to navigate in a very different world.
I do. I am aware, and I think you are too, that Palmer is working on a new book entitled The Politics of the Brokenhearted, Opening the Heart of the American Democracy. And my guess is, just reading a few of the previews that he's written about that, he probably would wholeheartedly agree with you about the ethics part of financial literacy. I heard someone say the other day, students need to learn not just to do well financially, but to do good.
Yes. Absolutely.
And it just struck me, wow, isn't that the lesson that we should have learned from sports scandals, now financial scandals?
Yeah. Political scandals.
At some point in time, that you got to get to those ethical concerns.
You really do. I mean, watch anybody who pays attention to what's going on in the news. That's just constant. And you know, to think that those are just softer skills. I don't like that term, softer skills.
Mm-hmm.
They're soft. Yeah, right. It's the touchy-feely. Well, you know what? It's those softer skills that kind of brought down the country.
Yeah.
Because we weren't really behaving in an ethical manner.
Just to make sure our listeners know, you can call in to talk with Dr. Amy Penny on the subject of The Courage to Teach, a book written by Parker Palmer we have a series of workshops going on the subject of the spirituality of teaching, and you can call in at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Came across this line from Palmer. He says, like most college faculty, I've often been deprived of a deep reservoir of insight about teaching and learning. Faculty, unlike many other professionals, lack the continuing conversation with colleagues that could help us grow more fully into the demands of the teacher craft. And he also talks about the inclination to privatize, or I prefer balkanize, or
silos,
marginalize.
Working in silos.
We tend to, and he also says that faculty themselves often choose this mm-hmm. in order not to be too closely or regularly scrutinized. What is he talking about when he says he's been deprived of a deep reservoir of insight about teaching and learning?
I think you hit on it. I mean, we have a tendency, and I think this is especially true at the university level more than say, at community colleges. I mean, at a community college, we're all literally in the same building. Mm-hmm. So we see each other a lot more, and we're able to make
More collaboration.
Yeah, there is more collaboration. I think it is much harder at the university. I mean, I taught here as a graduate student and was here for 11 years. And, you know, boy, I had really no idea what was going on across the quad. I really only knew what was going on in our building. So I think that's kind of what he's talking about, that we really are deprived of, in some ways, the diversity that's inherent at so many universities, the different kinds of learning, different kinds of thinking, different ways of approaching problem solving, that we lose out on some of that because we are so balkanized in some ways, especially at universities. But it's true in community colleges too, but just not to the same extent.
There's some passage where he describes a workshop he tried to conduct, and immediately someone jumped in. This is mostly for college professors, and made some critical comment. You mean you haven't read so-and-so in German? And I think we tend to be a little hard on each other, particularly for trying to show our feathers and prove that we really know our stuff.
Yeah.
How do you overcome that, do you think, in a more collaborative approach?
I don't have any feathers to show off. But I think it's very hard. I do think it's very hard, especially for young faculty or newer faculty who are trying to get tenure. Boy, you have to be. I mean, you just have to be competitive. You have to spend all of your time getting your stuff published and in the right place. And that's hard. I mean, that consumes you. And I just think you have to accept that part of your life and say, this is the part of my life that I have to be consumed by this.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'll be at a different stage later on. But for me, it's a lot easier, you know, at Parkland and at many other community colleges, we have different ways of competing, I think, or showing off our feathers. But by and large, I think the collaborative nature and the camaraderie at least where I work is pretty intense. So I don't feel as much of the balkanization that Palmer talks about. But I'm not working at a university level.
At Parkland, compared to, say, the University of Illinois, mm-hmm. where do you encounter more negative attitudes towards the where students are at these days? What's that old line from the play? What's wrong with kids today?
Yeah, I you know what? I think it's everywhere. I don't think it's reserved for universities or community colleges. We're all seeing essentially the same students. You know, at Parkland, we see a larger population of what we would term underprepared students who didn't, you know, do as well during high school, weren't able to focus for a variety of reasons. And there certainly is no one thing that creates an underprepared student. Sometimes it's systemic. Sometimes it was the life of the student. There are so many factors that go into that.
Palmer seems to believe that the student who is disengaged or depressed or silent mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. non-active should be read and understood. First, he says you need to find where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get to know them. And then once you get to know them, you might understand better. But he also seems to suggest that this is a structural, systemic, social issue that across the board. In his new book that he's coming out, apparently he's going to do a pretty significant analysis about the divided self that mm-hmm. is reinforced by most of the way we distribute wealth, for
yeah.
example,
yeah.
in this society. And the class, particularly in K-12, the class tensions seem to disengage. And he also talks about disconnectedness on the part of faculty from each other, from their students.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there are structural issues, or to what extent should students take responsibility for their non-engagement? I've certainly encountered a few.
That's a book. I think mm-hmm. that would be a good book that you should write, Don. You have time
now.
You're
the assessment giver.
Oh, yeah. Again, you know, I don't want to sound too much like a broken record, but I think there's a lot of both and here. Yes, there are systemic reasons why students come to us. Palmer talks about them, about the fear that
right.
they don't know. You know, that there's so much that they don't know. There's so many things that create fear.
Well, so many of us tend to feed that by
yes.
treating the subject as an object.
Yes,
and that's what he primarily complains about.
Exactly. So that we're not, if we focus so intensely on just the content, then we might lose the ability to connect deeply with the student, and especially the student who is coming out of a very difficult background, a very difficult situation. You know, the more I can know that, there's no question the better teacher I am. And if I have, you know, 300 students, it's very hard for me to get mm-hmm. to know that student. At Parkland, you know, we don't have quite that problem because we have smaller classes, mm-hmm. so we are able.
You have a lecture hall at the university with 300, 400 students.
Right, exactly. And there are some professors out there, they're able to do that, and I think that's a marvel, especially. I had some here at the university that are just amazing lecture professors. But, you know, I do think that it is, once you can understand the situation of the student, it does make a big difference. I mean, my office mate and I constantly, you know, you're navigating on a case-by-case basis this unmotivated student, that unmotivated student. I mean, they all come in with different stories, mm-hmm. and it's a big part of the job. It's what I have to do, is know enough about the student to know what's going to be the best way I can help this student. Is it going to be a real mm-hmm. hardcore teacher and do the tough love thing? For some students, that's great. And for another student, I'm going to need to sit and do just a lot more one-on-one therapeutic mm-hmm. work. And that's exhausting, and you have to have a really deep inner landscape to navigate through that.
And lower class sizes.
Yes, and lower class sizes, absolutely. I could not do it if I had 300 students a day.
Palmer says, we cannot see the fears that haunt our students because we ourselves are haunted by the fear that our students have rejected us.
Yeah. I mean, we talked a little bit about this on Friday. Our group, our spirituality of teaching group, met on Friday, and we talked a lot about the fear. He talks all about that in the second chapter of this particular book. Our fear, their fear, our fear of people thinking we don't know enough, especially our students. Palmer mentions in his recent work, Undivided Life or Undivided Self, I'm not sure. I can't remember right offhand, about us older people, teachers, especially older teachers, wanting to, we want the approval of the young. And he talks a lot about helping other teachers overcome that fear that we're not going to have the approval. So we want to teach what they want to hear because we fear not having the approval of our students and especially younger students. And I've, you know, I don't know if I experience that every day, but I do see that as a real underlying issue that promotes some of the disconnect that we're talking about that I think, you know, we want to kind of use spirituality to heal.
We also talked about teachable moments at that workshop and some of our more remarkable, memorable experiences with teachers. And then I want to invite anybody to call in if they have a teachable moment that you'd like to recite that is a more or less spiritual experience of the sort that Parker Palmer and Dr. Penny are talking about, or if you'd like to describe some of your more spiritually intelligent, to use a Howard Gardner term, professors or teachers, you can call in at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's talk a little bit about these. He's got a list of tensions or paradoxes. Do you know what I'm referring to?
I do.
One of them, he says, is the space in the classroom is so important. And he says there's a paradox. The space should be bounded and yet open, hospitable and yet charged. What's he getting at?
One of my colleagues, Dorothy Voiles, always she was the department chair of the English department for quite a while and taught at Parkland for a while. And she talked a lot about this, and that's something that really stuck with me during the time that she was a colleague at Parkland. The environment is really and truly important. A couple of other faculty and I really pushed hard to have a different kind of room setup. I know this sounds minor, a different room setup to promote a different level of discussion, to have a smaller groups sitting around tables doing thinking in different kinds of ways, kind of like a seminar setup. And that's what we were really pushing for because it promotes a different level of awareness and thinking.
I've been around too long. I remember so many of these spatial experiments back in the 60s and 70s. We've been playing with those for a long time. I don't know if there is.
And it's worth continuing to play with them.
There you go. We have a caller from Champaign. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or comment?
Yes, I do. Hi, I just kind of checked into the discussion a few minutes ago. But
thanks for joining us.
Thanks. I have a question and a comment. I have a master's degree from the University of Illinois in educational policy studies. And I remember being horrified by some of the agendas going on with education, which I'd been just totally uninformed about. I mean, before grad school, I was shocked. I mean, and I even went through some grief because my country, Tis of Thee, was suddenly like, you know, how can we through education get the most bucks out of our population kind of thing. And the example that sticks in my mind is, you know, the thing about putting Coca-Cola advertisements, you know, painting them on the wall of a classroom, which has happened in return for Coke donating money to that school. You know, and that's, you know, that's 20 years ago when I was in grad school, and now we have kids who are, I mean, a lot of children and adults who are obese, I see a connection there. But I guess I just wanted to make that comment. And I think my question is, you know, as I've gotten older, I've gotten more concerned about what we're doing to the environment and whether we will survive what we're doing to the environment. So I know everybody has an agenda they want taught, but sometimes I think, you know, the thing that people really need to learn is how to, you know, grow food sustainably and learn about ecology and so on and so forth. So I wondered if you would comment on that.
Thank you for your comment.
Sure. I think one of the things, you know, this has been a real big issue, and I would argue a spiritual issue as well, thinking about the environment and sustainability. At Parkland, we started a sustainability campus committee and made it actually one of our standing committees from the Parkland College Association. So, you know, it's a huge issue for us, and I know it is for the university as well, and a lot of colleges in the area. And I think it gets to what the previous caller was saying, too, that, you know, there's so often very little room in the curriculum, especially in K through 12, and especially when learning outcomes are so much the focus, and things that can be measured are so much the focus, that things like environmental teaching, more sustainability teaching, like we said, ethics, and those kinds of things get dropped off, or they might get short shrift. So I appreciate what the caller's saying, because you know, we do need to focus on sustainability, but I do think there's a lot of creative teachers out there, especially at the university and at community colleges, but who are focusing on ways to connect math and science and all of social sciences and the environment, and finding ways to emphasize that for students and to help students. Certainly at Parkland, you know, we want to help students in the career field get jobs in sustainable careers that are focused on sustainability. And so I think a lot of community colleges are going that way, especially those of us who have, you know, big career programs and things like that. It's becoming very important.
Again, we're getting back to what is it we cram into this curriculum?
I know it. Yeah. I think one of the things that Parker Palmer would say is that it's discussions like this among colleagues that are so important. Because there is only so much you can cram into curriculum. There are only so many gen ed objectives you can have. I mean, at Parkland, we have a host of gen ed objectives, and I know the same is true at the university and other colleges, where we want our students to have everything: aesthetic awareness, global awareness, civics, ethics, math, science, critical thinking.
And then the problem is doing any of them well.
Yeah, and how do you know you did them? And where is it in the curriculum? You know, that's one of those things that definitely keeps me up at night, figuring out where that is in the curriculum and how I can demonstrate it.
North Central is coming to Parkland and not too far from now, and they do have what do they call it, the integrity criterion?
Yeah, admission and integrity is...
What you claim you do you really do?
Do you really do it? Yes, I believe the Higher Learning Commission is either here now at the university, or I think this October is when their site visit is, or maybe it's sometime just this year, and they're talking about it this October. But so I know the university is thinking about it as well. How do you demonstrate what you do? And their criterion for, the Higher Learning Commission's criterion for, is can you demonstrate that you're teaching and that students are learning the general education objectives that you've set forth?
Historically, by the way, Parkland has done very well.
We have. In fact, we've done so well that my colleague Dave Leake and I are a little frightened, because we're the facilitators of the self-study this time, and the last self-study was so well done by Sally Wallace and Larry Thoreau that we're a little intimidated.
Let's just change the subject a little bit. Palmer apparently likes metaphors.
Yes.
He says, the image of teaching that I had absorbed from the academy requires the professor not to create space but to fill it up, a task that I'd learned to perform with a vengeance. What's he talking about?
Well, I think anybody who's been through graduate school, no offense to graduate school, but I think anybody who's been through graduate school knows what it is to have to stand in a room and fill it up. I think he's talking especially about that kind of teaching where you really have to get in there and prove yourself, you know, to demonstrate to your students that you're smarter than they are, and especially when you're a young graduate student. I mean, I started graduate studies when I was 21, and my students were 18, mm-hmm. So I had a lot of filling up to do. that first day of teaching at the University of Illinois in 1989, I actually sat in the classroom before my students got there, and I didn't tell them that I was the teacher. And I was just petrified that first day of teaching in August of 1989 that I had to do something out of the ordinary because I was just utterly petrified because I knew I really had very little, you know, above and beyond the 18-year-olds I was about to face. And so I just sat in the middle of the room, and I kind of let the first couple of minutes of class go by, and the students looked around, and they were kind of staring at each other and thinking, well, when is the teacher coming? And about 3 minutes into the class, I was sitting in the middle of the room. I jumped up on the desk that I was sitting on.
That sounds like you.
Yeah. And I said, I forget exactly what I said, but I said something about, okay, who is ready to learn about these estatements? And their jaws dropped to the floor because I just felt like I needed to do something to
shake them up.
To shake them up and to wake myself up to say, all right, this is a new role. I got to do something different. This is not Amy, the sit-in-class, take-notes learner. This is Amy's got to facilitate some learning, so let's get up on a desk and do it.
Now, I think you've been doing that ever since, from what I've
been trying.
Heard.
I also had a colleague who said a couple years in, oh, you know, yeah, you're teaching freshman composition now, but you're going to hate it and be glad that you've moved on. You know, we have to do this as drudgery as an English graduate student. And I'll never forget that he said that, and I'll never forget that I've never felt that way. Love teaching. I still do love teaching writing. I do love teaching freshman composition, and mostly because I love teaching freshmen.
Some critics of Palmer, the Back to the Basics folks, would worry about that quote about filling up the classroom.
Yeah.
Because if you back off from that and try to get to know the students, be therapeutic, be communal, to try to create a social atmosphere in the classroom that takes away from time for quote-unquote learning. Mm-hmm. How would he respond if someone made that comment?
I'm not sure how he would respond exactly. He'd sit back and say something very reflective and quiet, and then I would take notes on it and have to think about it later. but I think it can. I think it can take away. You know, when I think about one of my math colleagues, especially at Parkland, she crams every minute of her class. And I've sat in on her and watched her teach, and a lot of students just love her class. But it is cram-packed with math.
Mm-hmm.
Math, 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 math. Every minute is math. Every
immersion.
It is math. Mm-hmm. And she's a darn good teacher. And she does, you know, but she still takes the time to get to know her students. Her students feel very comfortable coming to her office. And so it might be that, you know, you're in a very content-heavy area like that, and you're going to focus on math during class. There's not going to be as much repartee in the math classroom necessarily. Now, I know some other math teachers who are a little bit different from that. But, boy, those students know what they know, you know, at the end of the semester, and that she's really helped them become better learners.
Last call for calls. We're talking to Dr. Amy Penny on the subject of the spirituality of teaching. And we're focusing on a book by Parker Palmer entitled The Courage to Teach. And if you'd like to call in a question or comment, we just have a few minutes left. The number is 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Well, we kind of left the paradoxes that we were talking about earlier off. Let's talk a little bit about the paradox of bounded versus open space, or the space in the classroom should be hospitable versus charged. He also talks about silence and speech, a ideal learning community, a community of truth, he calls it, should welcome both silence and speech. What is he getting at with these paradoxes?
I think he's getting at something that it's really taken me 20 years to learn, and that is the less you come in to fill up the space, and this is especially true for me, for my own teaching practice, that the less I come in with a jam-packed agenda and the need to fill up that space with what I know and share what I know with those students, the more I'm willing to be flexible and let there be silence. Boy, that takes a long time, I think, to get bold enough in a class to let that silence sit there when you've either asked a question or you've presented something and there's dead silence. I'm real comfortable in that silence now. I certainly wasn't And I think that was part of that filling that space up. I'm very comfortable because I know so many learners. My husband was one of those learners who learned best probably by just sitting there thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's not everybody, but I know that that's true for
many
learners.
Some people love lectures.
Yeah, I do. I personally do. I love a good lecture. And I learned far more in lectures, I think, than small group discussion. Now, I do both in my class, a little lecture, a little discussion, little projects, because I know some learners learn in different ways. But, I think that we need to let there be those silences because some students need to let things sink in. Mm-hmm. And we need to not be afraid of those. And I'm sure that's what Palmer's talking about there.
I once heard a principal say that the ideal teacher should teach from tone to tone.
Hmm.
You know, in public schools, you ring the bell at the beginning and you ring the bell at the end.
Yeah.
And frequently he would walk down the halls, and if there was too much silence, he would pop in and raise questions. If there was too much noise, he would raise questions. It's something about in between.
Yeah.
I think that's what Palmer was complaining about.
We need balance.
Palmer says, our deepest calling is to grow into our own authentic selfhood as teachers, whether or not it conforms to some image of who we ought to be. And as we do, he says, we will not only find the joy that every human being seeks, we'll also find our path of authentic service in the world. That's very much his Quaker coming out in him. But here's my question about that. If teachers take this advice, many might discover that they chose the wrong vocation, don't you think?
They may well. I've had that thought many times, as much as I love it. And I kind of wish there was an authentic selfhood store, though, kind of like Dollar General. I could go to this authentic selfhood store and get some authentic self. People have to really discover what that means for themselves, and that's easier said than done. I do think some people will go deeply into that inner landscape, deeply into reflecting on their authentic self and discover that their authentic self may have changed. I mean, I certainly kind of wish I had gone a slightly different direction in some ways. There's other things I'd like to be doing now to help people more. I'm hitting that point of life when I really feel like I need to help people more. And some days helping students craft a thesis statement doesn't feel like I'm really saving the world. But I think in the bigger picture, it is when I think of it as helping students think critically and navigate some of these, ethical and global questions that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. That they do certainly that in their writing and in their communicating.
What do you hope comes out of these workshops? And what was your experience last semester?
I want to save the world, Don, and that's kind of what I'm hoping for. My experience last semester, really, we just had one session last semester where we kind of slowed down. We did it at the end of in April when everybody's exhausted and crabby. We had a little meditation session in April. And I think what I want is to help facilitate everybody to think about that inner landscape, whatever that means for them, moving towards the authentic self. Or maybe away from the self altogether. I have enough Buddhist in me to think that maybe sometimes what we need to do is stop having a definition of the self altogether.
There you go. A Buddhist would say maybe that's the wrong thing.
Exactly. The teaching that can be taught is not teaching, to steal from the Tao.
That sounds very Buddhist.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, we've been talking with Dr. Amy Penny, who is a professor of English at Parkland College. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Don.
We have been talking about Parker Palmer's 1998 book, The Courage to Teach, Exploring the Inner Landscape of a Teacher's Life. And the focus has been on the question, is there spirituality in teaching? And we want to thank you for listening this afternoon, and join us next week when we talk about Pauline Christianity with Dr. Jennifer Little. Thank you very much for joining us. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
There's something magical about making words. Ask any parent what their baby's first word was. Chances are they'll remember. Words are what set us apart from all the other animals. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, people dedicated to the well-chosen word. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening at 7.
WILL programs are funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians since 1984. A shuttle service for customers is also available on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.